This podcast was originally live streamed on the Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. New episodes air weekdays, Monday through Friday, at 8 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. For the latest news, polls and updates throughout the day, follow us on Twitter at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. That's NONSEQ show. If you'd like to get exclusive content, bi-weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, backstage access to chat with guests after shows hosted on your channel and much more, become a Patreon saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur today while the limited spots are still available.
The following podcast is intended for those who believe bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
Because I know he's dying to do it, I'm going to allow, in honor of Pi Day, Steve to do his nerd thing. So, Steve, go ahead and nerd out for us.
Okay. Nice. Oh, shoot. 3.14159265358979, 3238426.
We get it. Dang. It's still good.
3382, I think. Somebody can look it up.
Nice. Anyway, happy.
I can do a blindfold too. I'm not like, I'm not looking. 3.14159265359. Yeah, I can say, I can do it. Go ahead. What?
I was going to be eating a piece of pie for Pi Day, and my wife was like, that sounds disrespectful. Don't do that. And I was like, I think they'd think it's funny, but you know.
Oh, that's right. Hilarious. You should have done that. You totally should.
Dr. John Croon claims that he had pi memorized to 20,000 decimal places.
No. Wow. Impossible.
The world record is like, what's the world's record for that? It's like ridiculous.
Yeah, I watched a documentary about recently. It's thousands. It's tens of thousands, isn't it? It's ridiculous. I don't know. I can barely remember 3.14.
There's like a really small handful of people that don't forget anything. It's been recorded. They can literally remember vivid memories and details from like 30 years ago. They don't forget.
Every one of my exes were like that.
The record is 68,000. 68,000 decimal places.
Never forget anything. Wow. I see. By the way, before we jump into a little bit of a conversation that I want to have before we start this debate, let's go ahead and say hello to our I'm getting a little bit of an echo. Does somebody have – Steve, are you hearing that, or is that just me?
No echo.
I'm hearing a slight echo.
Yeah, I'm hearing just a little bit of one.
Oh, really? Okay.
Go, Steve. You've been gone for 6 days and already forgetting. But I want to say hello to Steve and Dave really quick. Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. I'm looking forward to tonight.
Hello.
Hello.
And we'll internet connection. Hopefully you can hear me well, but it's going to be like an extreme strobe light effect with my movement.
We can hear you. You sound loud and clear, and we'll get perfect to know them a little bit deeper here in just a second. But I see a lot of people in the chat saying, "Oh, Steve's back. Welcome back, Steve. Glad to have you back." Yeah.
Oh, you know, I'm glad to be back. Thank you. Yeah.
I bet you are. Of all the times that you choose to take your vacation, you leave me with the hell that has been the past 4 days, 5 days, 6 days.
You know, maybe. That was planned. That was so planned. I couldn't have asked for anything better. I mean, it made my vacation so much even better going, I don't have to deal with any of this shit. Thank you, Jesus.
We did a stream on Friday where we talked about the decision to platform, and some people were saying, you know, you looked angry, Kyle, and I was angry. The entire time I was like, Steve, that son of a bitch, leaving me here to, I was angry. No. Speaking of that,
you did great. Honestly, you did. I watched it on vacation when I was out. I saw your video on Friday. I thought you did a wonderful job. I thought it was well articulated. I thought you guys did wonderful, actually.
Thank you. David Worley does a podcast. If you follow me on Twitter at Nonsex Show, you can go and there's a link to it there. But I talked about what he calls Ethnogate in detail. It was about 3.5 hour show. Wonderful guy. I definitely recommend checking him out. And that's on my Twitter. You can catch it there. Speaking of Twitter, I saw a post today by a really good friend of not only myself but the show in Godless Cranium. I don't know if any of you out there, some of you know about what happened, but this is quite alarming, and I'm just going to read the letter that Godless Cranium got today from YouTube. It says, "Hi, Godless Cranium. During a recent review, our team of policy specialists carefully looked over the videos you've uploaded to your channel, Godless Cranium. We found that a significant portion of your channel is not in line with our YouTube partner program policies. As of today, your channel is not eligible to monetize, and you will not have access to monetization tools and features. Please go to your monetization page to read more about the specific policy our specialist flagged. We know this is tough news, and sometimes we have to make difficult decisions. We have a responsibility to ensure our community is safe for creators, viewers, and advertisers. At the same time, we understand that you may have unintentionally made mistakes. That's why you'll be able to reapply for the partnership program in 30 days. This 30-day time period allows you to make changes to your channel to make sure it's in line with our policies." Well, I have news for you, YouTube. Godless Cranium doesn't need to change a damn thing about his videos or the way that he does his channel. He always has informative videos. They're never vitriolic. They're never to start drama or anything like that. They are just his responses to some of the things that he sees. I don't get that, Steve. Do you understand where this is coming from? Like, what the motivation for this is?
Well, I mean, I understand their motivation. I understand YouTube's trying to crack down because of the problems they're having with advertisers on certain videos, and I get that, right? And I think that the motive behind it is admirable. However, the way they're going about it is inefficient and affecting actual content creators, providing pushback to a lot of these topics. For example, the algorithm, as far as I know, isn't yet able to distinguish between people that are just talking about a topic or countering a topic other than promoting it, right? Or rather than promoting it. So you have all these channels out there that the algorithm just says, oh, this topic is this, and therefore it must be promoting it. And you have to have some kind of human oversight. And unfortunately, YouTube is so large. How are they going to have that level of oversight at this stage of the game? It's just not possible. They want the algorithm to learn. So what's going to happen is you're going to have these, what I'm going to be saying, false positives, I guess. I think that Godless Cranium probably will get it back monetized. But it's way the algorithm has to learn through some kind of neuro-linguistic programming type thing or whatever programming method it's using to learn, to adapt, to say, okay, this is a channel that actually promotes it versus this is a channel that's just talking about it. Huge difference there.
Stephen, you were saying something about Mike Winger got hit.
Mike Winger got hit because of a video. It was the title of one of his videos. I can't remember exactly what it was called, but it was something like refuting Jewish roots movement. Something about the title flagged YouTube, and I think it was probably the word refuting and the word Jewish in the same context, and so it was probably seen as anti-Semitic by some program or something. Mm-hmm. And he had his whole channel on lock. I believe it was demonetized until further actions could be taken, and he freaked out over it. I mean, his whole channel was at risk because of this one mistake, and eventually from emailing YouTube and some of his followers respectfully emailing YouTube, they eventually got it sorted out. But yeah, it's scary stuff. Keeps me, it lets me know I better back up everything I have just in case.
To clarify, he God's Crane has since posted an update. And by the way, David Worley, feel free to go ahead and post a link to that in the chat. You're more than welcome to do that. It says, here's why your just channel wasn't. Here.
Huh? Oh, I see. I was asking about the chat.
Oh, that's okay. It says, here's why your channel wasn't approved for monetization. In most cases, you can't re-upload someone else's content unless you get permission first. Remember, it's not enough to credit the content owner or state no copyright infringement is intended. This is saying that it was because – oh, I bet it's because he uses people's clips in response videos.
Who doesn't do – I mean, that's YouTube. Everybody does that. That's since day one. That's how YouTube gets started. You have 15 minutes, and what you did is you made a response video to somebody else's response video. That's how it got started, basically. That's all it was.
That's ridiculous. What are they doing, man? What are they doing? Okay. That's going to obviously impact – Godless Cranium. So if anybody is able, check out his Patreon and see if you can't give him a little extra support. I'm sure he's going to need it because that's a big rug to have taken out from under you without, you know, any sort of warning. I mean, there's that's the thing. There's no transparency. Like, there's no warning or clarification. Some channels get hit with it. Some channels don't. And it's strange. Like we had Replacing Darwin, that debate get demonetized, yet the slavery debate was monetized. I mean, what are they? Well, seriously, what are they doing?
There's no rhyme or reason. Yeah,
there isn't. Okay, so let's meet who we have here. Going by the discussion that we had before the show, this is going to be a really good talk. I believe both of them brought up the point that usually this subject can get kind of dry at times, and I think that the way they're going to approach it tonight, it's going to make sure that doesn't happen. No pressure, guys. But I think these are two really good guys, I can tell. So this is going to be a really good talk. It's nice to have you both. Stephen, we'll start with you. If you want to take a second and introduce yourself and tell people what you do and why you do it.
Sure. Long story short, I actually did not grow up Christian at all. I lived about as countercultural of a life that you can imagine. Eventually, I did become a Christian, but very shortly after that, in Bible studies, I was the most annoying person at Bible study, coming up with questions that people would respond to me with, well, you just got to have faith. I knew that there was something wrong with that. I didn't know what was wrong with that. But I knew that either all of this was a bunch of garbage or that they were at least wrong about this blind faith mentality to any approach or any question that they didn't have answers to. So, you know, that led me down the path of apologetics, got really into apologetics. I was never a reader my entire life. And when I got into apologetics, I read hundreds of books in just a few years that I would have never otherwise even attempted to be interested in. And that eventually led me to teaching apologetics at my local church. We travel to a few different places and teach at different conferences or get-togethers at a few other churches. So I want to equip Christians to think critically to have good reasons for their beliefs, to have at least thought through some of these arguments, to be aware of popular atheist arguments or apologetic arguments from other worldviews, so that they can have a slightly more intellectual conversation than, well, I was raised this way, or, you know, I believe this because I want to. So beyond that, my purpose for everything that I do is to equip Christians, you know, for their own edification, for evangelism, obviously, and then lastly, to affect the culture at large. I think right now, I'm sure you guys are familiar with how it feels to just be put in a box immediately. If you tell someone, you know, I'm an atheist, they immediately assume a lot of really negative things about you, especially in terms of morality, that are not justified or merited. And in the same way, if I tell someone I'm a Christian, a lot of people immediately assume that, you know, I'm an idiot, or I blindly trust this or that. I don't have valid reasons for my thinking. Or they assume a lot of things specifically about my Christian belief, which I usually don't. So I want to break down those barriers and the gap between people that believe in Christianity and people that don't. I want to minimize that gap so we can have better conversations with one another that are not mm-hmm. so heated or emotional. My ministry is called Standardized Apologetics. You can find us on Facebook. That's probably where the most attention is given. But our YouTube channel, I'm trying to regularly contribute to that. And we do have a huge focus in videography. There's not a lot of apologists doing vlogs right now, so I know that's one of our big focuses. I personally enjoy vlogs. Like, I love watching Casey Neistat and PewDiePie and stuff like that. And I want some of that within this material that I'm actually interested in. So that's what we do. And if anybody has any questions about that, I'm always down to talk about it, but looking Excellent. Forward to this conversation. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. Thank you for being here. And Dave.
Howdy. No, this guy, I like this guy. You did well finding this guy. So I'm Dave. Sorry. I'm doing a PhD in theology by publication, which I will briefly explain because people might not necessarily know what that means. So instead of a traditional PhD, which is writing 80,000 word thesis and defending it via Viva and that kind of thing, PhD by publication is basically you write a number of papers, you then become affiliated with the university and then defend it via Viva. So instead of writing 80,000 words, I'm writing papers. I've written the first draft of my first paper, which is, it's actually relevant to this discussion, but I won't be bringing it up because it's not been peer reviewed yet. So obviously I don't want to bring up something that could theoretically be, you know, thrown back in my face, but it's about the third day motif in the Gospel of Mark and whether it's possible.
Yeah.
The author of Mark misunderstood the idiom, which, and it's an idiom that Paul used, and accidentally kind of historicized what is actually an idiom. So he took something that's not a literal amount of time and then made it into a literal amount of time. But I'm writing a paper about that, which hopefully I'll be writing the second draft probably as soon as this debate's done, because this has been taking up a lot of my time. I'm also writing a book about the resurrection. Well, among other things, the resurrection. It's tackling the three major strands of Christianity. So God exists, the resurrection happened, and that Jesus is the Messiah. I am a non-theist, so I'm taking the position that God does not exist, that the resurrection didn't happen, and that Jesus is not the Messiah. Other than that, I have a blog, which is dmspence.com, in which I call it the home of counter-apologetics. It would be if I actually posted stuff fairly regularly. It usually comes up sort of in conversations on Twitter, and something comes up, it piques my interest. I write a blog. I also have a channel on YouTube called Dave S., which is even less frequently used, which is unfortunate. But given everything that I've got going on, I am trying to get around to doing everything. But I also want to try and start doing more debates, because like Stephen was saying, the best way, I was trying to come up with the phrase before. I don't know if this is a phrase, but the best way to sharpen your sword is with the hardest rock. I don't know if that's a phrase, but I'm going to go with it. So basically the best way to deal with any sort of objections to.
Uh-oh, Dave. Your mic cut out on you again. If you can hear me.
Yeah, I can't hear. I can hear you guys.
You might need to refresh again. To that quote, though, I believe it was
iron sharpens iron.
Yeah, I believe it was Richard Nixon that said that. I'm trying to find it.
Can you hear me now, by the way? It was,
yes.
Perfect.
For what? What term? What quote?
I think it was Richard Nixon that said that.
Mm-hmm. are we talking about the sharpening your sword on a stone, or? Yeah, I'm familiar. So it's a very Christianese statement about ironing, sharpening iron, and that's from Proverbs.
Maybe it wasn't.
I might be thinking of that then. I might be thinking of that. I hope
we go.
Yeah, and so basically, yeah, I hope that Stephen is able to present the best case he possibly can. I'll present the best case I possibly can, and people can really then make their own mind.
Excellent. Do you have a preference between the two of you? Which one of you wants to go first? We're going to give you 15 minutes for these opening statements, but I wanted to see if you had a preference on which wanted to start us out.
I'm definitely willing to kind of talk about it with DM. It seems, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like it would make more sense for me to present the case the way it is that we're kind of all familiar with. And then mm-hmm. your whole thing is kind of reactionary or a bit of a surprise. So, you know, we can have the standard argument presentation that everyone here at least is familiar with. And then you can kind of unleash the Trojan horse and we'll see what's inside.
That sounds perfect to me. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Sounds good to me.
All right. Whenever you're ready, I will start your time, sir. So you can begin whenever you're set.
Sure. So let's start now. So we talked before this about how I'm going to be presenting a case called the minimal facts approach, which is a very common way to present this argument. And actually what's funny is before the debate, I had probably a dozen people messaging me suggesting I take the minimal facts approach. And I'm like, yeah, that's the approach to take. That's the classic tried and true. So the thing about the minimal facts approach that we're trying to address here is, this is an argument that they've heard before, and so it's not like I've got all-star points that they have no idea what to say to. They're used to talking about them or responding to them. I don't think that the minimal facts approach is necessarily weak or bad. I'm excited to hear what their responses are, because my purpose in this debate is to find where those holes are in my own argumentation and then take notes and address them. So I'm here to learn as much as I am to teach and debate. So with that kind of out of the way, for those who are not familiar with the minimal facts approach, or at least the kind of spice that I put on it, let's jump right into it. So, and by the way, would you mind just giving me a little heads up about my time when I'm kind of drawing close? I don't want to go over my time.
Sure. What you want a 2-minute warning?
Yeah, that would be good. So we'll try to get through all the material here. There's a lot to it, so I'll try to share the minimum. But basically, this argument is extremely important. In The Reason for God, Tim Keller, he said that if Jesus rose from the dead, then you have to accept all that he said. If he didn't rise from the dead, then why worry about any of what he said? The issue on which everything hangs is not whether or not you like his teaching, but whether or not he rose from the dead. And so the significance of the resurrection of Jesus Christ cannot be overstated. It's literally the linchpin argument for Christianity. And everything stands or falls on the resurrection of Christ. So just as the resurrection is the center of all Christian theology, it's also the center of all Christian apologetics. So there's no argument that's more worthy of our time and attention. So the minimal facts approach, basically what it is, it's an abductive argument. So the way an abductive argument works, or at least the way that we're going to construct one here, is that we have our evidence, we have our facts, historical facts or otherwise, kind of laid out. And then we come up with theories that explain the facts. And then we make an inference to the best theory that explains all of the facts. So that's kind of the route that we want to take. So this is kind of an excerpt of criteria that Dr. Craig goes by, which I think most of us would agree with these criteria. So it's going to be the one that has the greatest explanatory scope. That's, you know, it explains more of the evidence. Explanatory power, it makes the evidence more probable. Plausibility, it fits better with the background beliefs. It's not ad hoc. It doesn't require additional unsubstantiated beliefs and is in accord with accepted beliefs. That is, it is disconfirmed by fewer accepted beliefs than its rivals and doesn't conflict with as many accepted beliefs than its rivals. And so with that said, let's get into the minimal facts. Let me kind of skip ahead here. Just for time's sake. So the three facts, for those unfamiliar, at least my my minimal facts argument is going to be constructed from the empty tomb. I think out of all of them, that's probably the best one, or at least easiest to defend from my perspective. The appearances of Jesus post-mortem, so claims to have seen Jesus risen after the dead, and the disciples' sincere belief in his resurrection. So these are all things that D.M. Spence will likely have studied and written a lot about, so I'm interested to hear what he thinks about all these things. So let's start with the empty tomb. So the empty tomb does have early independent attestation. That's a phrase that this gets thrown around 1,000 times in this debate. But basically what that means is there's dated early. I'm sure this is going to be something that can be contested too. The dating of these bits of scripture is something that's always up for debate and kind of going back and forth between Christians and skeptics and otherwise. But the three sources, such as 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 5, Mark 15, 37 through 16, 7, and Acts 13, 28 through 31, are a couple of the first ones that come to mind. There's a couple others. But one of the things about these that I think especially draws my attention is the first thing I want to talk about is the lack of legendary development. And so one of the things that apologists will kind of talk about at this point in the discussion is how compared to some of the non-canonical material written somewhat around a similar time frame, like, say, the Gospel of Peter has absolutely ridiculous theological and apologetical developments and embellishments. So, like, for instance, if you're not familiar with the Gospel of Peter, which is not in the Bible, it describes Jesus' triumphant exit from the tomb as a gigantic figure whose head reaches above the clouds, supported by angels, followed by a talking cross, heralded by a voice from heaven, all witnessed by Roman guards, Jewish leaders, and a multitude of spectators. That's clearly fantastic imagery, and that imagery is not just fantastic, but it has metaphorical meaning and whatnot, where it, in terms of Mark, it has stark simplicity. Obviously, it's not usually perceived to be simple that a man rose from the dead, but for an account that's making the claim that a man rose from the dead, it is very much lacking in that kind of embellishment. So in terms of the tomb, another thing that kind of establishes the empty tomb is the fact that it was public knowledge. So anybody that wanted to disconfirm the resurrection, they just needed to produce a body, which never happened. In terms of the Jews, who definitely had motivation to find a body and produce a body, they actually unknowingly reinforced the fact that the tomb was empty. In Matthew 28, 13 through 15, you can find the Jews actually saying that the disciples stole the body, which I personally think might meet the criterion of embarrassment as well for the disciples to even include that. But then again, they were kind of defending their case by saying so. But the point is, the Jews were claiming that the disciples stole the body. Therefore, them being enemies of the gospel writers, this is something that likely reinforces the fact that the tomb was indeed empty, because the Jews weren't saying that Jesus was still dead or Jesus was still in the tomb. They were saying the disciples stole the body. And another thing that reinforces the tomb is Joseph of Arimathea. So Joseph of Arimathea is one of the Sanhedrin. He's accredited as a man who donates his extravagant family tomb for Jesus' burial, and that fits the criterion of embarrassment. So again, this is an enemy of the gospel writers, or at least he would have been perceived to be an enemy of the gospel writers, being a member of the same group of people that orchestrated the death of Jesus. For the gospel writers to include a detail that one of them did right by Jesus by donating his extravagant family tomb is something that meets the criterion of embarrassment. They would not have written that unless it happened. They were trying to be faithful to the historical facts. And then finally, one of the biggest things that I think reinforces the empty tomb is the women discoverers of the tomb. So the original discoverers of the empty tomb were women. And we learned that a woman's testimony really was not admitted in court. It wasn't taken seriously. I know this point is contested by some people. I recently remember a debate where they were talking about this idea that there were examples of a woman's testimony being accepted in court. But realistically, the only testimonies that were accepted in terms of Josephus accepted a few testimonies because they were literally the only witnesses to the events described, or the only survivors to some kind of attack. And so had there been a man to question, he would have chosen them, but he chose women because they're the only ones available. And in terms of testimony in court, they were said to only be able to testify to their virginity and whether or not they were a widow. So they really were not given any opportunities to be taken seriously in terms of their testimony. This is actually from Flavius Josephus, who was a Jewish historian, who said, "Let not the testimony of women be admitted on account of the levity and boldness of their sex." That's from Antiquities. So the rabbinical texts, there's examples from the Sotah, the Kiddushin, the Barakos. I'm sure I'm slaughtering the pronunciation on these, but so these are some of the daily rabbinical prayers or phrases of the Jewish people popular at that time. So sooner let the words of the law be burnt than delivered to women. And again, happy is he whose children are male, but unhappy is he whose children are female. The daily prayer of the Jewish man included the benediction, "Blessed are you, Lord, O God, Lord, ruler of the universe, who has not created me a woman." And so if the writers of the Gospels lived in a culture where trusting a woman's testimony would be an embarrassing fact, and if they were fabricating or concocting a story that they wanted to be believable, they would not have chosen women to be the discoverers of the most important fact about this whole thing. So they would have chosen Peter or John, or they would have made somebody else the hero of the story. So the most plausible explanation for the women finding the tomb is that it happened. The women found the tomb. So the next thing to move on is the postmortem appearances. How am I doing on time, by the way?
You're at 10 minutes even.
I'm up to 10 minutes or 10 minutes left?
Yeah, you have 5 minutes left.
All right. So the postmortem appearances, basically Paul writes in 1 Corinthians, "For what I received, I pass on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried and that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas," which was Peter's earlier name, "and then to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me as one abnormally born." That's 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 8. So some of the things, I'm going to have to kind of fly through this material, but we can talk more about it after both of us have kind of given our opening statements. But the 500 witnesses at once is something that kind of stands out for Paul to say that there's 500 witnesses available to question right now. Some have died. A lot are still alive. He's effectively saying, if you don't believe me, go ask them. The witnesses are there to be questioned. It's a bold thing to declare in that area at that time if it's not true. James didn't believe in the divinity of Jesus through his earthly ministry. There's examples of that in Mark and John. Yet we found him in Christian fellowship following the resurrection. You can find that in Acts. When Peter escapes prison, he immediately sends word to James and his brothers in Acts 12. After the resurrection, James is seen as an apostle and pillar of the church, Acts 21:18 and Galatians 1:19 and 2:9. And again, from Josephus, we find in Antiquities, he actually wrote the plight of James, what happened to him, that he was executed. When he had formed an accusation against them as breakers of the law, he delivered them to be stoned. So James was stoned for his belief that his brother was the Messiah, that his brother was God himself. And so that's something that's really striking. Personally, if my brother came to me and claimed to be God himself, I would have a very difficult time with that, because I've grown up with him my whole life. I'm aware of everything that he's done. If he claimed to be perfect and have never done anything wrong, I would be someone who could definitely know about that. And so James' conversion, I'm sure, is something that D.M. Spence may contest, but we'll get to that when we can. Paul, obviously, is another one. So Paul was someone who persecuted Christians, and then eventually he had an experience on the road to Damascus where his entire life was turned upside down. He went from being a prestigious Pharisee to an apostle of Christ who championed the gospel across the Mediterranean world. He went through flogging, beatings, prison, lashes, beaten with rods, pelted with stones, shipwrecked, constantly hungry and danger, going without sleep. You can find examples of some of the things going through. Okay, in 2 Corinthians 11. Perfect. And so basically the apostles, by coming to positions of leadership in the church, they made themselves the largest target of persecution and abuse. When it comes to the sincerity of the disciples and the gospel writers, Essentially, you don't die for a lie that you know is something you fabricated. People die for lies all the time. They'll say, oh, somebody flew a plane into a building because they believed in a lie. But they weren't there when Muhammad wrote the Quran or whatever the religious reason they may have for doing so. And so if somebody believes in a lie, but they weren't there, that's different than somebody sacrificing their entire lives to something that they know is not true. So the last thing I'll say is that seemingly overnight, many Jews had abandoned their previous convictions to follow after Christ. The church flourished under harsh persecution. The Sabbath was replaced with Sunday worship. The meaning of baptism had changed. The Jewish Passover had transformed from a commemorative holiday to a communal meal that identified its adherence with Christ. And over a short amount of time, the whole ancient world was turned upside down by the events surrounding one man. So that's all I have to say. I know it's brief and quick. We kind of flew through the material, but that's our basic minimal facts argument without getting too far into it.
At 14 minutes and 30 seconds.
Sweet. Perfect. I was anticipating like 25 minutes, so that's why I had to kind of speed through.
You did good.
15, that's quick.
All right.
You learn to talk fast around here. Get it all
Dave,
in.
Whenever you start, I'll start your time. Uh-oh.
Can't hear you.
Refresh, Dave.
Excuse me.
Let's see if... Try it now, Dave.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes.
You're good now.
All right. So, before I get into my opening statement, I just wanted to thank the Non Sequitur Show for setting this up and hosting the debate. I want to sincerely thank everyone watching, and finally I want to thank Stephen for his really spirited introduction. Now, after listening to Stephen's opening statement, I can't help but be reminded of a passage in Proverbs 18:17 that the first person to speak seems right until one comes forward and cross examines. So everyone, grab yourself some popcorn, get yourself a nice lovely cup of tea, sit back and enjoy, because this is about to get interesting. So if anyone's ever seen the resurrection debate before, you'll no doubt seen the typical introductions on both sides. For instance, here on the Non Sequitur Show a little while ago, Paul debated Mike Winger about the resurrection, and the opening statements were pretty much what you'd expect. So Mike presented the minimal fact approach, and Paul brought up the typical issues associated with historiography. That when we're attempting to establish what most likely happened, we want multiple sources which are first-hand, contemporary, independent, who corroborate without colluding with each other, and are unbiased. While, of course, there is merit in pointing this out, I don't want to just simply repeat what Paul was saying in that debate. So instead of going through the same objections he brought up, I'm going to explain some of the other issues with what's referred to as the minimal fact approach. This is not to say there's not merit in what Paul was arguing. In fact, I certainly echo a lot of his sentiments. But today, I'm going to be focusing on the main problems, specifically with the minimal fact approach and the facts that Stephen is relying upon, which Paul only had time to touch upon. So before I get into this, I want to say that historical research, hopefully this goes without saying, is not a vote. As Dale Allison correctly puts it, I'm always much less interested in counting noses than in reviewing arguments. So the question is, did Jesus bodily raise from the dead? However, in order to answer the question of whether the resurrection is historical, I won't be relying on appeals to X number of scholars say Y. Instead, I'm going to be reviewing all of the evidence put forward to see if we have sufficient reason for believing any of these are actually facts. In order to do that, we must begin by critically reading the Gospels and the Epistles of Paul, built upon a clear and comprehensive understanding of the historical context of first century Palestine, the religious context of Second Temple Judaism, as well as providing an account of where and indeed when the documents of the New Testament were written, as well as acknowledging the wider context of Jesus' resurrection within the context of Christian theology as a whole. But before I get into all of that, I just want to point out something incredibly important. The resurrection of Jesus is not just interesting to ponder whether this happened or not, but to claim that Jesus rose bodily from the dead is necessary for Christianity to have any hope of being true. So Stephen clearly has a huge task ahead of himself trying to prove the resurrection happened, because if he cannot make the case successfully, as St. Paul points out in 1 Corinthians 15, if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless and so is your faith. More than that, we are found to be false witnesses about God. And if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile. You are still in your sins. If only for this life we have hope in Christ, we of all people are most to be pitied. However, while this is commonly interpreted that, according to Paul, the resurrection of Jesus is a fundamental requirement of Christianity, and that via the use of a contrapositive argument that if Jesus has been raised, then Christianity is true, this makes the assumption that the resurrection is not just necessary, but necessary and sufficient to establish the truth of Christianity. Now, there's a problem, given this passage in 1 Corinthians 15 is intended to make a larger theological point. He's writing in response to the charge that the benefits of Jesus' resurrection are already here. So contrary to the popular apologetic, the point here is almost the opposite of what Christian commentators are claiming, that the resurrection validates the truth of Christianity. Instead, while Christianity necessarily requires the resurrection, this alone does not establish the truth of Christianity. Now, I'm sure 1 Corinthians will come up later, and I'll respond to what Stephen has already claimed later on. So I'm going to be arguing that we do not have sufficient evidence to claim the resurrection of Jesus did occur, based on analysis of the extant evidence we do. Now, I could, if pushed, put forward my own explanation of the best for the evidence we have, and account for the emergence of the Christian beliefs as a growing legend which was developed to rationalize the death of Jesus. However, instead, to make sure the burden of proof isn't unfairly shifted onto me, and thus commit the fallacy of an argument for ignorance, in order to prove my case, all I will do is prove 3 points. So first of all, I'm going to challenge the underlying structure of the minimal fact approach, which apologists often rely upon to make the case that Jesus did resurrect. I'll challenge the hypothesis that God raised Jesus from the dead, based on the criteria of historians in coming up with the most reasonable explanation of the past. And finally, I'm going to critically examine each of these so-called facts, which apologists lean on to make their case. I'm going to do this more so during the cross-examinations we do. So while I could offer my own explanation, and I currently am writing a book about this, in which I provide a few of my own facts to perform what I call maximal fact counter-apologetics, to lay down the case that the best explanation we have of the extant evidence is that the resurrection of Jesus can be best explained as a rationalization of a dead messianic claimant. However, it must be noted that the burden of proof should not be put onto me to offer an alternative explanation. Instead, the burden of proof is on Stephen for making the positive claim that Jesus did raise from the dead, while all my burden is today is to show that this evidence we have is not sufficient to say that Jesus did rise from the dead. To use an analogy, imagine if one evening someone claimed they'd witnessed a UFO in the sky and claimed it was an alien spacecraft. While you may not be able to offer an alternative explanation, it's perfectly acceptable to simply remain unconvinced that it's an alien spacecraft. Simply being unable to offer an alternative explanation does not validate the view that it was an alien spaceship. Therefore, one is perfectly entitled to claim that they're merely not convinced that it was an alien, but there's no requirement to put forward their own explanation. Thus, my own burden of proof is to simply throw doubt on Stephen's claimed explanations for the evidence we have. As Matthew S. McCormick notes, advocates of the historical resurrection have sometimes argued that unless some naturalistic explanation can be successfully defended, then we must accept the supernatural conclusion. If the naturalist explanations we can come up with are all doubtful, then the resurrection must be real. There's a mistake concealed in this seemingly reasonable approach. Even if it turns out that a number of proposed naturalistic hypotheses do not readily fit with what we believe are the facts about the case, it would not follow that these failures alone that we should default to the supernatural explanation as the best hypothesis. So with this in mind, I'm going to go through some of my many issues of the minimal fact approach. As I mentioned, I'm currently writing a book about the resurrection, which goes through no less than 20. That's right, 20 problems with the minimal fact approach. Obviously, due to time constraints, I can't go through all of these, but just to highlight the most salient. So to begin, I want to challenge the minimal fact approach, which Stephen employed, which he seems to have just uncritically accepted and regurgitated, if you pardon the pun, as gospel. Given time constraints, I can only briefly talk about some of these, but to hopefully highlight the problem with just uncritically going along with the minimal fact approach without really grappling with the issues. Now, I wish I had more time to go through all of these, but notice how Stephen just jumped into saying that these are facts and that he seemed to imply that this is a consensus of historians and that any explanation must include all of these facts. But there is a number of problems with this line of reasoning. So Stephen is claiming, Stephen didn't imply this, but he's not claiming the reliability of the whole New Testament. It must be noted then that the rationale for the minimal fact approach, whether he wants to admit this or not, is because scholars since the 18th century or so have continually challenged the reliability of the New Testament. Now, I don't have time to go through each instance now, but needless to say, when one critically reads the New Testament without the presupposition of inerrancy, there's actually very little historical information contained within. And thus, the minimal fact approach is to try and separate the resurrection from the rest of the New Testament because of the absolute hammer blows that have been dealt to the New Testament writings. And so it's really the admission that scholars cannot reasonably assume that these are historical accounts. And so by compartmentalizing some of these and calling them minimal facts, seems to be the admission that even apologists can't possibly hope to defend the reliability of the entire New Testament. Second, Habermas's list of scholars is not a systematic literature review, but instead is basically the names of scholars and whether they write in favour or against each issue. Thus, a third and related issue is that this therefore doesn't consider the value, expertise, or even the field of study of each scholar. As William Lane Craig or Richard Swinburne's apologetic books are viewed the same as historians who consider all of the evidence, who know the original language, who have formal training or expertise in historiography. In other words, while Stephen kept stressing these are facts that come from historians, not on the lists are even historians. What's more, even those who are included on the list don't view these facts as facts. Although it's not part of the three minimal facts that's typically employed, if we look at the empty tomb, there are many scholars who may lean towards accepting the empty tomb, but don't regard it as a historical fact. To highlight this, take one example, Dale Allison. He's gone on record saying that he believes the empty tomb to be more likely than not, but doesn't consider it a historical fact. In fact, he acknowledges that there's a great deal of uncertainty about it. So as he states, looking back over the debate regarding the empty tomb, there's no iron logic on either side. There's a decent case for it, and there's a respectable case against it. Both sides, moreover, have their faults and suffer from a scarcity of proof. Neither exercises all of our doubts. So while Allison goes on to claim he finds a slightly stronger possibility that Jesus was buried and the tomb was discovered empty, there's a huge chasm between claiming that an empty tomb has a slightly stronger possibility of being true and considering this a historical fact. Thus, while Habermas presents this as a minimal fact approach, not all scholars even view these as facts. And finally, because I don't have enough time to go through all of the issues, the last one I'll go through is that there's a huge problem with what's being argued by the apologists as it relates to the actual explanation that they're putting forward. In other words, what exactly is the resurrection hypothesis? So although vast amounts have been written about the resurrection of Jesus, the most specific hypothesis which is often used is simply, God raised Jesus from the dead. And there are five major problems with this. Number one, this ignores the improbability of a resurrection. Number two, if the apologist claims the prior probability of Jesus' resurrection is high, this then begs the question. Number three, even Christians can't agree as to what the specific hypothesis should be, as some claim that Jesus was raised in a sense that could be seen after his death in the same sense that as he died as he was before, while others completely disagree. Number four, even if we assume the hypothesis God raised Jesus from the dead, this doesn't actually account for all the minimal facts, which any explanation has to account for. And finally, number five, even the Christian apologist Mike Lacona points out, historians cannot say that God raised Jesus from the dead is the most likely explanation. As Lacona notes, the background knowledge is difficult to agree upon when it comes to the resurrection of Jesus, since it involves the probability that God exists and he would want to raise Jesus. In other words, we would have to provide the relative probability that the Judeo-Christian God and that he would want to raise Jesus. Therefore, the background evidence required for completing an assessment of the probabilities is at best almost inscrutable. Yet even if God exists, there is no way for historians to know whether he would want to raise Jesus. Furthermore, as Lycona goes on to say, questions pertaining to the cause behind the event, i.e. who or what raised Jesus, the mechanisms behind the event, i.e. how precisely it was accomplished, and the precise nature of Jesus' resurrected state are beyond the reach of historians. What this means is that while apologists and those defending the reasonableness of the resurrection hypothesis are incredibly keen to point out the superiority of the resurrection of Jesus to account for all the minimal facts, even assuming these are facts, the hypothesis doesn't seem to be operationally defined, sufficiently specified, or applied in a consistent manner to actually account for all the basal facts that any explanation is said to account for. Now, I will get into each of these claimed facts shortly, but I just want to point something interesting out. Although Christians view this event as the perhaps most single, most monumentous event in the entire history of mankind, what soon becomes apparent is that, unlike many events from the ancient world, we cannot securely date the crucifixion, and thus by extension the resurrection, with any certainty. For instance, we can date the death of Alexander the Great to June the 11th, 323 BCE. Equally, historians can say with confidence that the assassination of Julius Caesar occurred on March the 15th, 44 BC. Yet for Jesus, We simply have no idea when any of this was meant to have happened. While I've no doubt Stephen has his own views about when Jesus died, there's simply no universal consensus of when this precisely was meant to have occurred. So to hopefully open up the conversation and start with the first of what I consider to be the minimal facts, while Stephen may argue that even atheist scholars say the crucifixion of Jesus is a historical fact, surely if I ask some simple questions, then we'd be able to answer them. So to begin, when did all this occur? Now, I'll explain this in more detail in a second, but scholars have disagreed about the year, ranging from 21 to 36 CE. The season is often debated as well, whether it occurred in the fall or the spring. Scholars are also divided about the month of Jesus' crucifixion, and thus the resurrection. The specific date, whether the 14th or 15th of Nisan, which day of the week, whether Wednesday, Thursday or Friday, or even the time of his final trial before Pilate. So given we cannot date this with any sense of certainty, this should surely throw some doubt upon the rest of the facts, when we don't even know when this is all meant to have occurred. But to round off now, I just want to point out that apologists just simply repeat the same arguments and pieces of evidence without really grappling with the complexities of the issues. To be fair to Stephen, he offered a pretty good presentation of the approach. But the trouble is, these are the same arguments that Habermas, Lycone and Craig have been putting forward for years. And this isn't just coming from me. Gary Habermas himself has claimed, to date, too many evangelicals have been complacent, largely attempting to write to each other, repeating old presentations of evidence for Jesus' resurrection without really grappling with the contemporary concerns. For this, we deserve criticism. So hopefully we can go through each of the claimed facts, and I'd like to critically challenge Stephen, and then we can open up the conversation from there. Thank you.
Okay. Excellent. So we're going to go into kind of a conversation now, back and forth between you two. Stephen, do you want to begin maybe addressing either a point that you heard Dave make, and we can go from there?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously we disagree about a lot of different points, but there were so many things that I really loved that you said. So your point about how apologists typically accept and regurgitate tried and true arguments or old arguments or dry arguments, as we said before, that's criticized for. I fully agree. The only reason that I've presented the minimal facts approach is that's the one that we're all familiar with. I would like to go farther into it. I'd like to examine it. I'd like to reason with you about your disputes with it. There are some different avenues in terms of the whole apologetic world of looking at. In terms of the resurrection, I have to admit that this is not my strongest argument. It's something that I've studied to where I can understand it and talk about it. So I would love to learn more about it. But two, the way that I probably didn't represent this in my opening statement, I probably should have. I don't want to be misrepresented here. My purpose in, hopefully you can't hear that, my computer gets loud every once in a while, but my purpose in presenting the minimal facts approach is not necessarily to say the resurrection happened and it's more likely than your theory. What I want to rest on, what I want my claim to be, is that belief in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, based on the minimal facts approach, is a reasonable belief. That's it. I think that's a more modest approach, and maybe you can kind of attempt to undermine that approach, but I don't want to say that the evidence far outweighs doubt in any way. So I build a cumulative case, arguments for Christian theism in general, for the resurrection, for the divine trilemma is something that I really like. And so it's actually kind of the antithesis to your approach. You know, your arguments against God's existence, and then you go to the resurrection of Jesus, and then you go to Jesus, even the Messiah. So my approach is literally the antithesis of that. So I think we think on a similar wavelength there about what's important and the prominence or the order of importance, the kind of the route that we have to take. So I think that's kind of cool. I actually like that. So in terms of that, I think there's other things I wanted to talk about, but that'll be my springboard. That's what I wanted to, at least I wanted to frame my intentions well, so that it's represented. Does that make sense? Can't hear you. Oh,
refresh.
Let's get
speechless.
Like a piece of paper and a marker.
Yeah, Steve needs to do his sign. Steve's slacking on his sign.
Well, no, only you know the sign. He won't know what that means. This means your mic is not working. There's a universal sign for you're muted, or you need to do something.
Can you hear me now, by the way?
These are contingencies.
Yeah, there we go.
Play.
I'll do that if I'm refreshing. So that's the sign for microphone start working. That's the sign for refreshing. Okay. Cool. No, excellent. I can't really disagree with a lot of that. I think we will get to a point possibly where we just agree to disagree. There's a section that I'm hopefully we do touch upon of the notion of a fulfilled prophecy. And I've been talking to someone on Twitter about this, and it seems to be that the reason why Christians are Christians is the same reason why I'm not a Christian. And that's basically that they obviously are convinced with the resurrection. But not only that, but they're convinced that Jesus is the Messiah, and that the Messiah necessarily had to die and resurrect in order to be considered the Messiah. So the reason why they're Christians is because they then look through their Jewish Bibles and go, ah, see Isaiah 53 or Psalm 22 or Zechariah 12:10 or whatever passage they want to go and say, aha, see, this was all meant to happen. This was part of the plan. And that's the problem. That's where the rubber hits the road for me. It's whether you go, did this happen? Or was then the New Testament written in reaction to Jesus dying, people going, this was not part of the plan, and then had to come up with a reason why this was meant to have happened. So you may turn around and say, Isaiah 50, perfect, case in point, Jesus is the Messiah because the suffering servant was meant to die and resurrect. Okay, and I will get into this later. Mm-hmm. For me, it's a case of, I don't believe the passage says that, but it's a case of, and Jesus wasn't the only messianic claimant. He wasn't the only person in the first century who claimed to have been the Messiah, or I don't think he claimed to be the Messiah, but who people thought he was the Messiah. Nor is he, not in the first century, but one of the famous ones is Shabbat Tzvi, who not only he didn't actually die, he actually did something possibly worse, and that's convert to Islam. So if you're the Jewish Messiah who converts to Islam, what do you do if you're Jewish and think he's the Messiah? Well, what you do then is go back to your Jewish Bible and say, ah, this was meant to happen all along. And obviously the passages would be different than Isaiah 53 and so on. But this is what's happened throughout the past. There's another one, another person called Simon in the second century. All these seem to happen. And yet you don't follow Simon. You don't follow Shabbat Tzvi. You follow Jesus of Nazareth. And you can say, the minimal fact approach to the resurrection. But fundamentally, where the rubber hits the road isn't the minimal fact approach. It's the one fact that needs to be established is, was this meant to happen? Was this part of God's plan? And I think that's why I'm interested to go into things like the crucifixion. Not only do I think we have very reason to question when it happened, but if it happened at all, based on a reading of Daniel 9:25-27, if you have any experience of that, if not, I can talk you through the Christian apologetic of it and the problems I have with it.
Okay, so just to be clear, we're kind of at that point where we're just spitballing back and forth now. Like we're just kind of, this is just a dialogue.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah,
absolutely. So one of the things that I think you're spot on about, I can definitely see how you would interpret some of these fulfilled prophecies or coincidences in the Bible and attribute that to a way to kind of naturalistically date some of this, or even talk about falsification of evidence. And it doesn't, I don't claim that you're claiming it's even nefarious, that sometimes people can just believe something and write it down that way. But I do find it interesting. I was recently, in preparation for this, I was watching that Mike Lacona debate. Actually, it wasn't him, was it? It was, it was someone else. I forget the name. But he was going through, it was versus Craig, actually. It's one of the first ones that comes up. But Craig was talking about, actually, Craig didn't even address the prophecy issue because they weren't directly related to the minimal facts approach. And Craig is an iron cage. If you're not immediately addressing something that he's talked about, you won't address it. You could think what you will of that, but that was to him irrelevant to his case. But as this person was going through and saying, see, these are the evidences for how the New Testament is falsified or myth-making, and they would reference Psalm 22, Isaiah 53, and a lot of other, it was actually a ton of coincidences and symbolism that I'd never even known about, that I'd never heard about, such as the person who ran away naked from the Gethsemane scene where Jesus is being arrested, and then he's shown again, come back, but he's wearing white clothes, to symbolize like the nakedness of fallen and sin and coming back, being clothed in white.
and that being kind of a motif or symbolism for the resurrection. And so it's almost like, you know, these accounts are simple on the surface, but if you dig deep enough, you know, there are these kind of theological, if you want to call them, embellishments or coincidences. And what's interesting is, as I was hearing him say this, because I have that supernatural worldview, you know, I have a Christian worldview in which I'm not going to defend it here. We don't have the time for it, but I do believe that the Bible is the inspired, infallible word of God. I don't think that Christianity necessarily rests on infallibility, as evidenced from, you know, tonight's debate. That's not something that if we learn tomorrow that the Bible's not infallible, and a bunch of Christians are tossing their Bibles into the trash, I would not be amongst them. That's not something I rest on. But I think since I have that kind of supernatural worldview, that I interpreted those things as God ordained, you know, and that might sound silly, but to the contrary, if you have a naturalistic or atheistic worldview, then obviously you are predisposed to interpret those things as dating issues or whatever else. And so it's hard to see the facts by themselves without bias. And I know all sides are going to try to claim that they have the neutral ground or the middle ground or the fair ground. But I don't think that's how the burden of proof works. I think every single person has a worldview, and every single person has to account for their own worldview, including some of these things, which I think are foundational. Later, but I did have some quotes that I thought were awesome that I think you would agree with in terms of this idea where your predisposition is obviously going to affect things. That's something we all have to work through. It's the difficulty in assessing what's true and what's not true. So, yeah. Any more?
Okay.
If you've got other things, by all means, I'm down to respond. I've got more stuff from you. If you want me to keep rolling, just let me know. Otherwise, keep rolling.
He's got to refresh real quick.
Oh. Okay. Well, I want to give him a second if he wanted to respond to something I said.
Yeah, I think he does.
Okay. You might refresh.
Yeah. Is it? Can you hear me now?
There we go.
Good. Yeah.
Yes.
You're all good.
Yeah.
Universal. Every time I stop talking, it seems to cut out. So. Yes. I completely agree that no one comes to this neutral. No one is value free in this. No one is coming to this completely independent of anything. Everyone has their own. I think Mike Lacona calls them horizons. Basically, our own baggage is the easiest way to come to it. I'm a non-theist. I don't believe in God. What you want to call me from there? Some people call me an agnostic. Some people call me an atheist. Some people call me non-cognitivist. Either way, I'm not a theist. That's the best way to describe me. That doesn't mean I'm neutral in this. Like you say, just because you're a Christian, that doesn't mean you're biased. You'd like to think we both have a bias towards wanting to know what is true. So this is something that's the difference between exegesis and eisegesis. So we both hopefully are performing exegesis. We're both trying to get to the core of what the author was trying to say, not imposing a meaning onto a text that we have a predisposition to try and infuse onto it. Now, whether the New Testament authors had that in mind is the debate fundamentally. But I guess for me, I know you didn't mention it, but could we possibly talk about the crucifixion itself to see, you know, for me, I have real issues with affirming it as historical, at least in the manner the Gospels report. At best, we could say the Gospels report something that's very questionable historically. Then you can make the additional step in the same way with mysticism. We could say, well, maybe Jesus, maybe there's no reference to him, et cetera, et cetera. There's then a step to say mythicism. I would say at least the Gospels portray a crucifixion story that's very historically implausible. So do you want to give your account or do you want to have a conversation about it? It's up to you.
Well, I mean, that's not something I've really prepared, I guess. So that's the minimal facts approach just kind of assumes that there is a resurrection or there is a crucifixion. I know based on my reading, at least from, you know, we can quote mine, you know, atheist scholars or Christian scholars on saying that the crucifixion of Jesus is the most well-established historical fact. But I don't want to get into the habit of claiming something and then just saying everyone's on my side, so there, without having something to back it up. And even if we decided to go further with that, I feel like we get our horns caught in this infinite loop of quoting the scholars that we're reading. I want to think a little more critically than that. Not that that's not important, but I would say that I'm taking the crucifixion with the argument that I've presented, I'm taking that for granted within the context of everything else. But maybe you have a refutation or issues with it where I could respond to. It'd probably be better for me to hear you first. No audio. You don't have audio again.
You might just want to refresh when you each time you get ready to talk again. That might it seems to drop when you stop talking.
Yeah, as soon as I talk, I don't know if that's a sign. So I guess I could present my case. I guess against the crucifixion, we can break this down point by point. I do have a script here, but I can break it down to each individual point. So. If we assume we knew nothing about the historical Jesus and went into this with a completely open mind going, okay, I've the first time I've heard about this, tell me when he was crucified. There's a number of problems. So if we assume that Jesus was crucified around Passover, that occurs in the Jewish month of Nisan, which occurs in March or depends on the it's a lunar and solar cycle. So in March or April of the Gregorian calendar. So in all of the Gospels, apart from Luke, it reports that Jesus triumphantly enters into Jerusalem and is met with crowds singing and celebrating and saying Hosanna and singing Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. So for example, in Matthew 21:9. So what's the issue with that? Why have we got an issue with that? Well, these come from Psalm 118:25-26, and that's traditionally associated with the Feast of Tabernacles, not Passover. In fact, the seventh day of the Feast of Tabernacles is specifically called the Great Hosanna. So what's the issue with that? Well, it's celebrated in September, not March. So it'd be like someone claiming they are celebrating Halloween and they're singing We Wish You a Merry Christmas. And in John 12:12-15, it reports that people were waving palms, hence the term Palm Sunday. However, not only is it unlikely that palms would grow in the Passover in the spring, there's no palm trees in the region. They have to actually be brought in from Jericho, which is about 25 miles away. But again, the waving of palm branches is associated with the Feast of Tabernacles. So in Leviticus 23:40, it says that on the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles, you were to take branches from luxuriant trees, from palms and willows and other leafy trees, and rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days. So it'd be like someone claiming they're celebrating Halloween, and instead of carving pumpkins or, you know, putting on costumes, they're singing We Wish You a Merry Christmas and setting off fireworks. So I fun fact, and this is, I want to say this in a very public forum, I've actually been blocked from the website Jews for Jesus from the chat because I mentioned this to a few people. They actually blocked me from going on the group chat, so I'm no longer allowed to chat on jewsforjesus.com. So fun fact there, fun endorsement there. And I brought this up and I didn't hear a very good refutation other than the fact, well, maybe Jesus entered Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, but then the crucifixion occurred in the next March or April, which for me kind of throws off the whole Easter week thing. So I guess, do you have a response to that? Do you have anything to say in response to that?
No, I wrote that down. I'm going to investigate it myself. I don't have a response to that. To me, it doesn't undermine the fact of him being crucified. But, you know, calling into question, when did it happen, is something that we would want to know. If we can know. So I'll have to investigate that. Is there anything else?
I guess the year. I don't want to go into the like time, because I think time, they didn't have clocks. It's not as if they had an alarm clock or their mobile phone and go, okay, he's crucified at this time. It was all, for me, it's a bit of a, not a red herring. It's something to build as a part of a cumulative case that they do disagree with each other. But the actual year, so we don't actually have a recorded date or year of the actual crucifixion of Jesus. All we have is Luke, who fixes the date to the advent of John the Baptist, or baptizer, as I like to call him, his ministry. Mm-hmm. So when he says that Tiberius was in the 15th year and gives the name of the rulers and the various people like Pilate and Caiaphas and all those, we end up with a date or the timestamp of with about 3 years, starting in 26 or 29. And if we assume a 3-year ministry, because John reports 3 Passovers, that's why we point to either 30 or 33. However, sure. And this is where we get into Daniel 9:25. And this is for me where the rubber hits the road, because, and I'm going to say this now, and I was going to say this closing statement, but I might as well say this now. For me, the trouble is with this, and this is where we will fundamentally probably not agree and probably never agree unless one of us changes our beliefs radically. The truth is indistinguishable from the perfect lie. I want you to keep that quote in mind when I read this out. So many Christians have argued that Daniel 9:25-27 is a prophecy which reveals precisely when the Messiah would arrive. So the calculation is a little bit complicated, but I can go through it if you want me to. But the long and short of it is that Christians claim that the prophecy of Daniel 9 said the Messiah will arrive on the 6th of April, 32 CE. They therefore claim that this precisely coincides with when Jesus rode into Jerusalem on the Sunday before the crucifixion on the Friday. However, a Friday Passover, which is the 14th of Nisan, would only have to be the April 7th CE or the 3rd of April 33 CE. So we can dismiss this on the basis of the fact that Daniel 9:25 has him crucified either 2 years late or a year, 2 years late or a year early. So again, I can go through the actual prophecy. Well, I say prophecy. Sure. I can go through the passage in question and explain the calculation. I can also explain this, that wrong if you want.
For you, if this was, you know, thoroughly in place, was not refuted, what would this ultimately lead to for you? Would this just be a blow to inerrancy, or would this be a blow to the literal crucifixion of Jesus? I mean, do you need to have specified when? I know it's not exactly comparable, but, you know, for example, my U.S. history is absolutely terrible. I cannot tell you exactly when. This is kind of an embarrassing fact when you reveal. I cannot tell you when Abraham Lincoln became president, but I can tell you that he became president. And so not having that timestamp is not an issue for me. I guess I'm curious about why is the dating, especially with it being within, from what I perceive to be a finite window, you're still placing it before the destruction of the Jerusalem temple, the great war of the Jews with the Romans. So I mean, what's in that for you, if you're going to go down that road?
Well, basically, if I don't know if there's a brief way of doing it, but Daniel 9:25-27 is apparently a prophecy which says that in 69 weeks, and it doesn't literally mean weeks, it means weeks of years. So 483 years after the decree for the rebuilding of Jerusalem, the Messiah, this is the King James Version, I'm just briefly paraphrasing, the Messiah will be cut off, but not for himself. And we'll basically the Christian reading of this is that 483 years from when this decree was made, which they claim is 444 BCE, if you add that on, you get to 39 CE. However, they then contend that the prophecy isn't talking about literal, like what we call solar years, but they're actually prophetic years. And prophetic years have 360, not 364, 5 1/4 days. So when you do the sums, it ends up with this specific date. So you get 173,880 days after Daniel made that prophecy is when Jesus precisely rode into Jerusalem. Okay, I will explain the problems with this later, but let's say that's exactly what it was. It would be a little, now this is where I was saying about the whole truth is indistinguishable from the perfect lie. It would be very, very convenient or very, very expected possibly to put Jesus crucified at that exact one, when they don't give him a specific date and time and, you know, or specific date at least for his crucifixion, it would seem very convenient that he would be crucified during this reign when it seems to perfectly coincide with this prophecy. Now you would probably say, well, this is God's plan for ordained. This is exactly what was meant to happen. The Messiah was meant to be cut off at this exact time. This is when Jesus rode to Jerusalem. It just makes perfect sense. It's like a jigsaw piece that just perfectly lines up. Or you could look back and say, well, maybe he was placed into history. So while there are a number of instances of Jesus' life apparently fulfilling prophecy, this might just be the most significant of placing him into history at that exact time. And this is where I get into the truth is indistinguishable from the perfect lie. Maybe that was the plan. Maybe God meant Daniel to write down this prophecy and that Jesus did exactly, whether meaning to or not, fulfill this prophecy. Or maybe someone made it up, someone did the calculations and thought, ah, well, there was this Jesus guy. And you know, I'm not necessarily arguing for mythicism here, but there was this Jesus guy. Okay, I'm going to fudge the dates a little bit and say he was crucified under Pilate. And this is the problem. We don't know which is true. We don't know whether it was a preordained part of the God's divine plan. I would argue it isn't, because there's a number of problems with the calculations. But this is where it could just be that he was placed into history at that precise time. And so we can then question at least that Jesus was crucified then. You could then take the step and say, well, we don't know when he was crucified, therefore he wasn't crucified. I'm not going to make that leap. But that's the problem, that you can read this prophecy and place him into history at that exact time.
Sure. So for you, this is not necessarily a killing blow, but putting a chink in the armor, you know, having us step back and reevaluate, you know, if this is an issue, am I correct in that, or do you think that it's bigger than that? I'm not that invested in this whole prophecy argument in the first place. So to try to dismantle it is, for me personally, I don't really care. I have a particular friend that I refer to and talk to about some Bible things. He's brilliant. He knows a lot. I have a lot to learn from him. And for him, he doesn't even believe in prophecy in terms of Old Testament to New Testament prophecy, the way that most people understand it or the way that most Christians understand it. I don't think I know enough about it to confirm or deny. I lean more towards prophecy, especially when I personally read the Bible and I see the connections or I see the thread of Christ throughout the entire Bible. I mean, there's a popular book from David Limbo where he basically shows where Christ shows up in every book of Scripture. And again, with that presupposition of your worldview, you're going to internalize that as either unfounded or extremely profound. And I'm not sure where I found myself on that spectrum, but there are things where I do find personally where I suspect something being about Jesus in the Old Testament, and that speaks to me. So I mean, for me, this is on the experiential level. I don't want to come off as just, I know some apologists come off like they're almost afraid to admit that they have a supernatural worldview in the first place, or that they have some kind of personal relationship with God. I said earlier that I'm disappointed when people rest on nothing but personal experience or anecdotes, and I don't want to do that. But I don't exclude those from my identity either. So these are obviously a big part of my personal belief. In fact, there's not a single argument from the whole apologetics repertoire that instills in me my particular belief in God. I find the arguments to be valid and sound, but my particular belief in God actually comes from, you can call it personal experience, but as Plantinga would put it, a basic belief in God, an internal testimony of the Holy Spirit. And so and you guys are probably familiar with that, but for anybody watching that's maybe not, the best way that I would kind of put it this way in the shortest amount of time, a properly basic belief, it's a belief that cannot be refuted because it's properly basic. It's a foundational belief, like the laws of logic or the idea that I think, therefore I am, like I exist. And so belief in God is something that's just as real to you as any of those foundational beliefs. And so for an analogy, if you were to put me in a courtroom and there was tons of evidence stacked against me that I committed a murder, and my alibi, even though I know I didn't commit the murder, my alibi doesn't check out, and there's DNA evidence against me, and there's eyewitness testimony against me, and it's mounted against me in a way that I couldn't possibly escape. I will be confirmed guilty, even though I know for a fact I didn't commit the crime. And so the question posed then is, if you know you didn't commit the crime, but the evidence is stacked against you, is it reasonable to agree with the case made against you, or is it reasonable to maintain your innocence because you know that you're innocent?
I'm going to step in here because we're moving away from the topic too far. We got to bring it back because we got 15 minutes to go. Bring it back to the minimal fact argument, and especially Absolutely. Which is the original part of it was the empty tomb kind of thing. Because I think when you start going into Plantinga and PBBs and things like that nature, we've gone way off the beaten trail.
That's fair. So where did we kind of leave off the last time we were talking about that? I think we were talking about kind of predispositions to supernatural worldviews. I think one thing that you mentioned was the scripture has been kind of under attack since the 18th century. But honestly, I think is that mostly kind of, honestly, as far as I know,
as the years go on, we gain more knowledge about the historical context of the ancient world, that we actually gain more manuscript evidence and things to actually gather. So in terms of our knowledge of the historicity of the ancient world, that's only improving. In terms of, I wanted to talk about the five problems that you had with God raised Jesus from the dead. Do you remember that you mentioned five problems? Would you mind talking about that? I'm kind of interested in that.
Yeah, can you hear me again?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah.
You got it. Excellent. So, Chris, I'm going to get my five up again because I can't remember
the first one off the top
of my head. So,
you want to do it like one at a time?
We can do, yeah. And then it's okay. We'll go through this and we'll find something to go through. I think the first one, oh, here we go. It ignores the improbability, a prior probability, so the improbability of the prior probability of the resurrection. In other words, the intrinsic probability of a resurrection is incredibly low, i.e. you don't see resurrections every day. And so as a Bayesian, we would go, our prior probability is one divided by the amount of times that people have died and stayed dead, basically. So one instance of apparent resurrection is incredibly overwhelmed by the amount of times that a resurrection doesn't occur. I probably know what you're going to say in response to this, but...
Right, yeah, I mean, that boils down to the predisposition to a naturalistic worldview. It's, even with the how do you pronounce it, the Bayesian formula?
Yeah.
As far as I know about that, I haven't finished my self-taught course in formal logic yet, but as far as I know, the numbers, the statistical values that you have to input into that formula are ultimately going to be very subjective. And so I think when you're interpreting or filling in the background information, that's going to be largely subjective and dependent on your interpretation of those theistic arguments. Is there a God, I think, is the biggest one first. And so from my perspective, with how convincing I find the arguments in God's favor to be, I don't think it's improbable whatsoever that a resurrection occurred, especially within the context of the history of the Bible and what Jesus meant theologically. I think it's to be expected, not by the disciples, not by anybody there at the time, but looking back, having the puzzle top, the box top, and seeing the whole image, I think that makes a lot of sense. What was the, if you wanted to respond to that, by all means, but what was the second thing, if you wanted to,
ironically, if the apologist claims the prior probability of Jesus' resurrection is high, this then begs the question. So that's the point you're raising, that if
we're not
you're
both
right,
doing that?
Then Jesus was, well, because you're saying if Jesus was at least who he claimed to be, or people believe him to be, then God would have found favor in him, and so it would have been more likely that he'd be resurrected than just average Joe, you know, who died last week. He wouldn't be likely to be resurrected, but Jesus, because he has God on his side, because he's on, you know, God's radar as being this awesome dude, he'd be more likely to be resurrected. But that's begging the question. You're trying to assume the resurrection. The conclusion of the argument for the resurrection is that God raised Jesus from the dead, but you need that to then input into the prior probability. And so what?
Oh, sure.
You mentioned subjectivity.
I'm just assuming God's existence within the context of this. I'm not assuming the resurrection. I'm making an inference to the resurrection.
Yeah. Okay. So my objection. Yeah, but my objection to your sort of analysis of Bayes, don't get me wrong, there are two schools of thought when it comes to Bayesian epistemology. So one is objectivism, okay, and one is subjectivism. So as you mentioned, there are subjective probabilities involved. So for example, you seem like a pretty honest guy, but that's me subjectively saying, from everything I've experienced with you, you seem to be more likely to tell the truth than not. So if I say, if you tell me you had a pet dog, I'd say, okay, given everything I know about you, 95% likely to be telling the truth, 5% likely to tell the lie. But that's subjective. That's not me saying, well, you've told me 100 statements and 95 turned out to be true and 5 turned out to be false. So objectivism, sure, is basically the view that we can compute how often something is true compared to how often it's not. So for example, if you roll a normal six-sided die, you can objectively say, as long as it's fair, as long as it's weighted, you know, isn't weighted unfairly, there's a 1 in 6 chance, right, or, you know, that a 1 will turn up. Whereas subjectivism is that it's very much, I can't compute. I've not lived your entire life. Everything you've said that's true, and I'm not comparing the two. My problem is that the apologist often makes the claim that it's my bias against resurrection states, but it's a prior probability is low. I think you need to contend with the fact that, you know, this is why people don't use Bayes, and I know William Lane Craig is kind of uses it when it suits and then doesn't when it doesn't.
I don't support using Bayes, by the way, as an apologist. I would not do that myself for any of these arguments.
The trouble is, I think
it's particularly useful for me.
Yeah, I can kind of see where you're coming from. I mentioned in my opening statement about Mike Lacona, he does it for the same reason, but it just seems to be like me saying, let's play a board game, whatever board game you want to go for. And you say, okay, let's play chess. And me going, actually, I don't like chess. I can't play that. Let's play drafts. For me, it's a little bit, I get me wrong. I completely get the objection that it is subjective. And you and I are never going to agree about the probability that God exists and that Jesus would have been someone who, it's not just an average Joe on the street who was being raised. It was Jesus of all people. We're never going to agree on that unless we both had the exact same, if you want to call it worldview or baggage or whatever you want to call it. But for me, it just be the admission that it's never going to be convincing, at least in a normative sense. But that's the nature of the beast. We, you know, in the same way when we talk about prophecy, someone watching this and someone going can Google the prophecy of Daniel 9:25-27 now, and I urge you to do it. It's a fascinating prophecy. But bear in mind that the Christian reading of it is based on a Greek reading of the text, which is very, very charitable to Christianity, let's put it that way. The original Hebrew reading of the text is
right.
It doesn't speak of that. It's also not a prophecy because he wasn't a prophet, but there you go. But yeah, so do you want to carry on with the five objections?
Sure. No, I would like to carry on. I would just say in terms of the average Christian interpretation of scripture, I think by and large is usually wrong or skewed because Bible interpretation is a very complicated task. I'm not afraid to. I'm sure you know how complex, especially cultural studies, comparative studies. I've recently been getting really into Michael Heiser, and I mean, he really unleashes the depth of all of this. That's not to say that I believe that the gospel is something inaccessible to the average person. Obviously, that would really undermine the point of scripture. But I think the finer details and some theological aspects are something that a lot of people, they interpret the Bible through their theological lens or their philosophical lens, and they don't arrive to the intention of the original authors or facts, historical facts regarding that scripture. Those are just my quick thoughts on that. So basically, I would agree with you that it's a complicated issue. What was the second one that you had of the five?
Research. We'll probably get to one or two more before we open up for questions because we're at the hour and a half mark now, but yeah, this is great. This is everybody's awesome. Impressed with how cordial you guys are to each other. There's such a rarity on here that it stands out.
We've been best friends for a really long time. We go way back. I remember meeting Spence in kindergarten. You know, we've had our spats, but we've always been friends.
Is that for real?
When I did kindergarten in America, yeah. okay. I guess.
Yeah. Available.
The rest of my points, I think we can you kind of touched upon with referring to the problem with different Christians holding different things. My third was that Christians can't seem to agree on what the resurrection hypothesis actually is. You and I can probably both agree that Christians don't agree on a lot of things, so the fact they do that, I can fully grant, I can completely understand why. And it's so basically the fundamental issue, and I do kind of want to touch upon, the trouble is there's so much to touch upon with the entire resurrection thing. For example, I've got an entire section there of the conversion of the skeptics, the testimony of women, the empty tomb, fulfillment of prophecy, yeah, suffering and dying, all of these things. I guess Steve or does anyone have anything particularly want to go through, or do you want to just wrap up with closing statements?
I have a question or so. Okay, one of the ways that Christians often argue this, especially with the empty tomb, is that they say that the risen Christ is the best explanation given the facts that they promote as the minimal fact argument. Now, using an abductive approach, which I think, Stephen, you often try to do, most Christians say that this is an abductive argument, going to what Dave was saying about Bayesian theory. If you use an abductive approach, we have in modern times seen certain things. We've seen people get stories wrong. We've seen, let's say that Jesus was put in the tomb. We've seen grave robberies. We've seen bodies stolen. We've seen people hallucinate. We've seen people just lie for whatever reason. These are things we have seen. Sure. We have past priors to these observations. To say that the best explanation is Jesus rising, one, we've never experienced anything like that. It'd be a bare possibility, just like it would be aliens came in and took the body out. So what, as a Christian, do you find compelling, knowing what we do now, and be objective, sure, in the fact that if this happened today, if you saw Dave, for example, if Dave was crucified or Dave was shot and he was put in the ground and 3 days later he came back, I don't think your first abductive case would be that, hey, he rose from the dead, right? You'd probably think that something else is going on here. So back then, granted, with the hair, I could get that, right? But back then, they were a lot more willing to. One second, let me finish. Because back then, they were a lot more willing to accept these types of things, right? They didn't have the scientific knowledge we have today. They were, and I hate to use the word superstitious, but that is true. They did have a lot of superstitions that we don't have now. So if this happened today, would you still hold that this was the best example of what would satisfy all the things for the minimum tomb, that Jesus rising from the dead is the best explanation for the facts?
So what I would say about the perspective of the original audience and the difference between us, I am particularly prone to, you know, a lot.
He's particularly prone to losing his mic. I think we lost him, Dave.
No, Dave's still here.
Well, that's just his muting problem, I think, though.
Well, you know what this means? When we lose a guest, that means I have to sing.
Hey, it was my turn to leave.
Back.
Can you hear me?
You're all like,
oh, thank you.
Steve asked one question and he's already out. No, go ahead.
I can't take it. All right. So what I would say in regards to the ancient audience and us, you know, saying that they're superstitious, I think that calling them superstitious almost colors the question in a way. I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you, but the way that I would frame the question is to say that they were more prone to have a supernatural worldview, which I don't have an issue with. That's not to say that science has not progressed or critical thinking or any of these things, but I don't think we give the ancient world enough credit with a lot of the ways that they thought about things. Like in terms of Jesus resurrecting, they didn't immediately assume that he resurrected. I mean, a lot of them thought he was an apparition or a ghost. They wanted to eat with him. They wanted to touch him. They were shocked. Thomas wouldn't even believe. So in terms of these other theories, like I was actually, you know, I got things prepared for what was it? You know, wrong tomb theory, hallucination theory, theft theory, the swoon theory, or apparent death theory. I don't find any of those convincing, and I have my, you know, the standard reasons for not finding those convincing. So that's why I thought DM Spence's approach was a little refreshing. It was different than one of those things, you know, saying, well, what if one of these are plausible? I don't think any of those are plausible. I think if you're going to undermine the resurrection account, that the best way to do that is to try to undermine the scripture itself. The Minimal Facts tries to not rely on the historicity of the whole New Testament, but it does rely on historicity of certain passages in the New Testament and other ancient sources that we have. So I think if you're going to be skeptical of something and try to undermine it, that's the area that you want to attach. That's the area that you want to focus on, because these competing theories, I think anybody watching, if you're not familiar, I mean, you can read about pretty much any Christian apologist has written on why these competing theories are unconvincing, at least from their own perspective. So that's why I personally think that the abductive argument for the resurrection is reasonable. Again, I'm not saying that you are reasonable for not believing. I'm saying that within the context of this worldview, this is a reasonable belief taken within a larger cumulative case.
All right. So we'll close it to Dave then. Oh, I thought you were finished.
Do you mind? Okay.
I wanted to share this really quick, and then I'll be done. But basically, this was something that I highlighted that I thought was awesome. Kind of talking about the back and forth, and finding that middle ground, where it says, for some on both sides of the issue, the answer is clear. Habermas, for instance, believes that the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus to be so strong that no sincere, knowledgeable person can rationally deny that this event actually occurred. Martin and Flew, on the other hand, believe the historical evidence to be so weak that a rational person should disbelieve the claim that Jesus was resurrected from the dead. Davis, however, offers a middle ground based on the currently popular distinction between simply defending one's right to hold a belief and arguing that no one can rationally disagree. As already noted, Davis believes personally that the historical evidence considered alone clearly supports the resurrection of Jesus. But he denies that sincere, knowledgeable individuals cannot justifiably disagree. Supernaturalists, he argues, can reasonably maintain that reality cannot be explained totally in natural terms, and therefore can be reasonably maintain the historical event supports an actual resurrection. However, naturalists can justifiably maintain that all events are part of the natural order that is uniform, and given this assumption, disbelieve in the actual resurrection of Jesus is also rational. In short, as Davis sees it, one's perspective on whether Jesus actually rose from the dead ultimately comes down to one's basic worldview, one's basic perspective on the nature of reality, since both supernaturalism and naturalism can be held by rational people, differing rational perspectives on the historicity of the event in question must be allowed. So I don't know that I'm perfectly in the middle, as Davis is, but I know that I'm not where Habermas is in saying that you are completely unreasonable in your doubt or disbelief. But I want to make my position reasonable. As C.S. Lewis put it, having the intellectual permission to believe.
Steve, did you want to follow up with Dave before I ask a couple questions that the
I think Dave wants to respond to that. He's probably going to go exactly where I was going to ask him anyway. So. Okay. Let him fix his mic, because I think that he's actually going to go exactly where I was going to ask him anyways.
Okay.
I'll do a preemptive strike there. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this was probably part of my closing statement, but I think it's as fitting now as it would be at any point. So the minimal facts approach seemed to rest on two pillars, the empty tomb and the appearances of Jesus after his death. And these are then propped up with what I consider to be circumstantial evidence of the apparent conversion of skeptics and the fact that Jesus's disciples died for their faith. However, we can kind of quickly dismiss the circumstantial evidence because for me, it just seems incredibly weak for both James's conversion and James's skepticism and Paul's apparent conversion. Now, granted, I'm condensing this, what would have been a rebuttal, so I assume I've already done that. And the empty tomb is not only, I think, incredibly weak, but based on a questionable assumption that Jesus would have been buried, and that the appearances of Jesus were not sufficient enough to establish belief. So while the minimal fact approach attempts to prop up or attempts to build upon these sort of basal assumptions or these basal arguments, neither of which of the direct pieces of evidence, that is the empty tomb nor the appearances themselves, were sufficient for belief in the resurrection 2,000 years ago. So if the empty tomb and seeing Jesus in front of Jesus' disciples after his death wasn't enough to convince them of the resurrection, then what actually did convince them? And you might have noticed that they were constantly confused and perplexed about Jesus' teachings. My favorite example is the Gospel of John, during the night of what he calls the Last Supper, in which Jesus says, "The person I give this bread to is going to betray me." He then gives a piece of bread to Judas. Then Peter, Simon Peter, turns to the beloved disciple and goes, asking what he means. And then Jesus turns to the Jews and says, "What are you going to do? Do quickly." And Jesus' disciples naturally react in the only way that anyone here would do and not understand what the hell is going on. That, for me, perfectly epitomizes a lot of the scenes in the New Testament, particularly the Gospel of Mark, but the Gospel of John obviously portrays it as well. But Jesus' disciples simply didn't understand what was going on. But then if you look throughout the New Testament, there's a number of times where Jesus specifically says his death and resurrection was foretold in Scripture. For example, John 13:7 and 19, Luke 24, verses 25 and 27, 44 and 45, Matthew 16:21, 20:17 to 19. But perhaps the most direct reference comes in John 2:22, that after Jesus was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he said. They then believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. So basically what convinced them wasn't this minimal fact approach. They weren't convinced by, well, we've got this, you know, where the women discovered the tomb, or they weren't convinced by the fact that people sincerely believed. They weren't even convinced by an empty tomb or Jesus' appearance. But basically where the rubber hits the road is where the minimal fact approach for me fundamentally fails, is because it doesn't deal with the issue that the reason why they came to believe was because of the scriptures, not because they saw Jesus in front of him. In fact, the whole point of the story of Doubting Thomas is to go, blessed are those who don't see and yet believe. So the narrative was, don't believe because you see physical evidence. What you need to believe in is because the scriptures preordained it. So the conflict between the core of, I'm going to say, Judaism and Christianity, or Christianity and non, you know, anything that's not Christianity, is what reason was it that made the disciples and Jesus' followers, or whoever you want to call them, believe? And it wasn't these appearances, it wasn't the empty tomb, it wasn't any of those things. It was, this was all meant to happen according to the scriptures. So this is, I'm going to radically, possibly for the first time, I don't know if anyone else has done this, I've not read it anyway, I'm actually going to reinterpret what Paul means in 1 Corinthians 15. I don't think when he says, if Christ has not been raised, then our faith is futile and we're misrepresenting God. I don't think he means that in the sense of, if Christ has not literally been raised and bodily raised from the dead. I think, consistent with the creed in 1 Corinthians 15:3 to, you know, 7, what he's saying is, if Christ has not been raised according to the scriptures, then we are misrepresenting God. In other words, if I'm saying that Christ, the title of Christos, you know, the HaMashiach in the Hebrew, if the Messiah was never meant to have been raised, if I'm reading into the text something that isn't there in the Jewish Bible, then I'm misrepresenting God. That seems to be a more natural reading of the text, not if Jesus wasn't walking around and talking around, you know, talking as a reanimated corpse, as the Gospel of John seems to make it seem. I don't think he's talking about that. I think he's saying, okay, if I'm wrong that I'm infusing a message into the Jewish Bible that wasn't there, that the Jewish Bible doesn't say the Christ must die and resurrect, then we're misrepresenting God. That seems to be what he's arguing for. And so for me, it's a bit of a red herring, this entire minimal fact approach, because it doesn't actually deal with, you know, what actually convinced the Jesus' disciples. And given we're 2,000 years removed from the event, talking about people, you know, we can't validate, I don't think, that Jesus was buried. The tomb was discovered empty, and we can't say with any confidence what Jesus' disciples genuinely believed, whether they took it to their graves. And I was going to do an entire section about the suffering and martyrdom, but obviously don't have time now. But yeah, fundamentally, apologists need to contend with the fact that the minimal fact approach is completely a red herring, because what convinced Jesus' disciples was the realization this was meant to happen the whole time. So when you ignore the minimal fact approach, you have to then tackle the very difficult question of, is the Jewish religion based on a suffering and dying Messiah? And the obvious answer is no. I mean, N.T. Wright at least admits that this wasn't expected. So the question you have to ask yourself is, which is more likely, that the best people to understand the Jewish Bible in the first century were Jews, you know, the Jewish people, and they said they rightly rejected it. In fact, Paul says it's the biggest stumbling block in 1 Corinthians to accepting the notion that was the crucified and raised Messiah. That's the biggest stumbling block. And yet we're meant to interpret that the best people instead to understand God's divine plan wasn't people who spoke Hebrew, because they were quoting the Septuagint, people who weren't, it seems to be, very educated, you know, well-rounded, researched theologians. They were portrayed as illiterate, or at least very poorly literate, followers of Jesus that then was obviously written in Greek, but that I'm kind of demarking the two there. So you have to ask the question, which of these is more likely, that the scriptures had been sort of, well, or, you know, the option is, which of these is the most likely thing, that the best people to understand the scriptures had their minds blocked by the God who claimed that they were their chosen people, then God turned his back on, or that some Gentiles, non-Jews, had a better understanding of the scriptures than the entire Hebrew population? And that's where the rubber hits the road. And obviously, I know I'm loading the question now, but this is where Christianity and Judaism and never the twain shall meet, because Christianity isn't just Judaism plus Jesus as the Messiah.
So I don't have a long response, but just right. Like 10 seconds.
Yeah, we're gonna have to wrap it up pretty quick here. So have you got some final
10 seconds
here?
I would simply say, Dave, even though we don't talk about it, Dave, I would say that the disciples
the disciples were predisposed against the belief in a risen Jesus. I don't think that anybody was expecting it or that that was fabricated. And so this conjecture about fabricating it, I think itself a red herring, that none of the minimal facts are red herrings, that that's the central point in the abductive argument. And I don't think this addresses any of that, especially the empty tomb, which to me is the easiest one to establish. But you asked a lot of good questions. There's the answers to those are largely theological, and those are things that we could probably spend a long time talking about. But that's it. That's all I have to say about it.
I have a couple questions that I pulled from the live chat that we'll ask real quick.
Awesome.
Stephen, what in your opinion would be the second best explanation for the minimal facts argument other than Jesus rising from the dead?
Yeah. I think second best. See, I love this question because this question puts me in a place where I'm forced to provide evidence that I've thought about, seriously considered my opponent's perspective and considered it, at least for a moment, to be possible. And so not just for a moment, I'd consider anything possible philosophically, but I would say probably corrupted text. I don't believe that the text is corrupted enough for it to not be historically reliable, but I think that, again, that's going to be an easier approach to explain what's going on here than something like swoon theory or theft, you know, conspiracy theories or hallucination theories. I think that those are all very weak, but I would go with corrupted text.
That was from Pine Creek. And by the way, guys, if you have not checked out Pine Creek's channel, make sure you do. He has fantastic conversations on his channel. But he has another one for you. And I think this is a good one, Stephen. He says, Herod and others thought that John the Baptist rose from the dead. Isn't this an example of people believing in a resurrection and yet being mistaken?
Being resuscitated, I would at least throw in the idea of the distinction between something like a resuscitation and a glorified resurrection. I would say that's going to be involved in that question. I can see the point they're making, but I think it's a little more complicated than that. I can't provide a solid answer right now.
Let me follow up on that. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't there, I think, four people that rose from the dead in the Bible, and plus dead people walking the streets?
Not in the way Jesus did, no.
Okay, so they were came back from the dead, but they're not resurrected. So they weren't resurrected, but they did come back from the dead.
This is going to be a silly analogy, but just to kind of make the distinction, imagine the difference between some like an angelic being with a real body, a physical body, versus a zombie that's rotting away. Okay. So basically, glorified resurrection means glorified in a body that will not perish or die again. So it's being resurrected for die, as opposed to just, you know, like the Lazarus situation, being brought back, but, you know, it's just delaying the inevitable. So that's not exactly the way that we would describe Jesus's resurrection.
He wanted to clarify too, and I think this is a good point, that he was beheaded, so that would be some resuscitation.
That's pretty good.
Sure would. Yeah,
that's a lot of mouth to mouth for that.
Yeah. A lot of duct tape. Okay, last one.
And duct tape fixes anything.
This is also to you, Stephen. Can Jesus be extensively found within the text of the Old Testament? If so, is it more likely that a deity planned this or that authors used these texts for the New Testament?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think for myself, I do not rest on prophecy as part of my worldview or my reasoning for believing. But in my personal I would say subjective experience of reading the scriptures, I do perceive Christ in the Old Testament quite frequently. And I think there's good evidence that there is foreshadowing of Christ, that the gospel is like the focal point and the Old Testament is foreshadow to that. So I think we kind of went over this earlier, where this is going to come down to
the predisposition you have to your worldview, that if you're predisposed to philosophical naturalism, that you're going to interpret this as the fuel for myth-making. And if you're predisposed to a supernatural worldview, you can still say that it's fuel for myth-making. You're still, that option is still open to you as a reasonable person. But I think another reasonable option that's open to you is that it's an orchestrated event. I think, not to trail off forever, I know we don't want to get into an argument about the attributes of God, but I mean, really, if we think seriously, philosophically about the nature of God, what about this is improbable? What does the word improbable even mean in a theistic universe? It's the same arbitrary distinction as the term miracle. What does the term miracle even mean in an actual theistic universe where literally every molecule in its position is a miracle at all times? So that's what I would say about that. I don't know that there's a great answer to that question. I think it comes down to your predisposition of your worldview.
Okay. Now let me read the super chat and then I'll let you guys make any final statements that you'd like to, and then we'll call it a night. This says, although not quite as fun as an R and Ra debate, I learned a ton of good points today. You guys kick ass. Thank you. That was, nice. Oh, I lost the name. That was from Jesse Bradley. Sorry about that. I almost lost the name. Okay. Dave, do you want to start us out with any final closing thoughts? And make sure that you guys plug your channels and anything that you've got coming up that you want to get out there that people can check out, all that good stuff too.
Sure.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Oh, you're good.
Perfect. Cool. Yeah. Quickly refreshed. No, really enjoyed this. I've more respect for you now than I did before. And I really like your channel. I urge everyone to subscribe. It's a great channel. Really open dialogue. I didn't, as much as I was preparing for a debate, I was hoping it was going to be more of a discussion because I don't want this to, well, I'm saying I don't want this to be combative. There's a small part of me that hope that, you know, but at the end of the day, I think fundamentally, I think we've kind of flirted with the issue of fundamentally, however we look at this is going to be tainted by however your starting point, your baggage, I'm going to call it. And for me, the fundamental issue is you have to pick one side or the other. You have to go with either that this was all preordained, that the Jewish Bible clearly predicted would happen and that it was finally fulfilled, or that the New Testament authors were either rationalizing the death or experiencing grief or dissonance or whatever you want to call it, and then came up with an explanation that fit the notion of a crucified Messiah. And that's what I've been flirting with. Like I say, I wish I had more time to go into all of these and the supposed facts. But no, I really enjoyed the discussion. I hope we can do something again because it's been, I hope people have enjoyed the atmosphere. It's not been confrontational, you know, I've not called you a bitch and you've not called me a whore. So it's brilliant. So yeah, I hope people did really enjoy this.
Great. Go ahead. Get your shots in. Come on.
They loved it. And they loved it. Absolutely. They're talking about right now how much they loved it. And Dave, what's the timeline on your book? Cause I'd like to actually have you, come back on, and, go into that a little bit too.
Send me a copy.
I will, basically I'm on 1056 pages now. It's 1.5 space, so not physically 1,000 pages, but yeah, it's how long is a piece of string. Basically it's three big areas. What I try and weave kind of story of, it's three separate books almost in one, which may end up being three separate books, but I can say, number one, God doesn't exist. But even if I'm wrong, let's say God does exist, then number two, the resurrection didn't happen. But let's say I'm wrong. Let's say the resurrection did happen. Does that mean Jesus is the Christ? And that's where we get into something interesting. And this is where I consider Christianity to be self-refuting, which is going to leave you on a bit of a cliffhanger there. So yeah, I'll give you updates about what I'm doing. What was that, sorry?
I was going to say, that was the part I was excited about. I was looking forward to talking about that. But another time.
Well, we're going to bring you back. We're
going to
bring you back.
Not going anywhere. Right. Dave's back from obscurity as he has risen. He's a longtime friend of mine. He's been around a very, very long time. We go way back, and I'm so glad that he's back. And I'm not letting him go away again. So
I'm glad to be back. Steve. So no, thank you for a great chat. So thank you guys, and thanks for hosting. You were excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. And Steve, you're gayer than I am. I just want to put it out there. And I'm pretty gay.
People have been telling me that recently. Yeah. I don't know.
Okay, Steven.
I like his hair. I'm jelly.
I'm not sure which one that was directed at first.
Oh, no, not this Steve.
I was like, wow. We just got done talking about how charitable this was, and he just comes out. All
right. Fine. So you're gay. In the broadcast.
Just so you know, like, I'm not, but I don't find that offensive. So, you know.
I'm actually, just to let you know, I am actually gay. So, I mean, I'm not throwing it out there to be an asshole. Yeah.
Yeah, no. You're just being cheeky.
Right.
is it my closing statement? Is that the time?
I think so. It's your time.
Sweet. All right. I would echo that. I really enjoyed this. What's funny is, I'm excited about confrontation and debate. I think I've been kind of geared towards that my whole life. But I'm also the guy that when I'm in line at the roller coaster and there's only, you know, one more cycle left before it's my turn, that's when I'm like, oh shit, I want to get off of the roller coaster. I don't want to be on this. Oh no. You know, just getting nervous and scared. And so thinking about this debate all day, it was just ravaging me. And I'm like, oh man. And some people told me, they're like, this DM Spence guy is, they said negative things. And so I was preparing for the worst. And I would say, I know, right? I would say that from my perspective, everything has been charitable. Everything has been great. And I don't mind people, you know, post discussion or after the fact that they're behind talking with friends and they're, you know, then they're like, that guy's an idiot. You know, that's going to happen. I don't have those plans here, but, the face-to-face conversation, was really refreshing. It was really charitable. I think that we did get to really address some issues. I'm sorry I couldn't respond to some of the things you were interested in me responding to. And I really wish there was enough time to cover more of the minimal facts. I don't think, if you're watching at home and you're, again, you're learning about this, you're not familiar, don't take everything I've said for granted. I mean, really investigate. I really do believe that the minimal facts approach is strong still. But I like that we're thinking more about this. And I like that we're trying to figure out, are there chinks in the armor? Are there holes in the arguments? And where can we address these things? So, in the whole spectrum of my journey through my Christian walk and apologetics and doing what I'm doing, all of this has been helpful. It's been obviously there's, you know, the helpful from exposure, putting your plugs in for the channel. But beyond that, meeting people that want to talk about these things in a serious way. Nobody here is apathetic about any of these issues. And I can't express how much I love that. What is most disappointing to me is anybody who seems to not understand the importance of these issues. I can understand someone who feels overwhelmed. You know, there's so many worldviews or religions or there's just so much to it. I don't know what to do with it. That I understand, especially if you're sincere and you want help. But to people that want to discount everything and not critically think about these things or just believe whatever they want to, for whatever reason. I have a lot more respect for somebody that disagrees with me, but wants to talk through the issues, than somebody who vaguely agrees with me, but seems to not even care. So thank you for giving me that, this platform, this opportunity to have this conversation with you guys. I'm hoping to have a lot more because as you said, iron sharpens iron. I do not want to be stuck in some sort of Christian apologist echo chamber. As you, I remember when you first started your opening statement, you're like, Steven's regurgitating this and accepting whatever, you know, and on the inside I'm like, hey, you know, but really, I don't want to do that. So let's think through the issues, come up with new arguments and new angles, keep working at understanding each other a little better to close that gap a little more.
Are you sure you're Christian? I've been doing this show for a long time, and I've never heard. I would love to tell you my story, honestly. I've never heard Christian say this ever. They never say, "Let's." I want to learn, or I could be wrong. Those are two things I've never heard a Christian say.
Let's ever. I mean, that's how I arrived here.
Well, good for you.
I would love. Yeah, maybe post or some other time we can talk about, like, because I'd like to learn about you guys on a personal level. I'm curious about. What led you to?
I would like to talk to you about Plantinga and properly basic beliefs and foundationalism one day. If you're
will you please?
I'd be totally down for that.
Yes, we'll have you back on to talk about talk about our stories, but not planting or whatever he's talking about.
No, he. I like my channel for something.
I do quickly have questions about: Are we going to be talking privately in post, like after this, for a brief time, or when it's done, it's just done?
Yeah. No. We'll stay on the call when we close out. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. All right.
Just a couple quick things. Congrats, Shannon Q. I'm not gonna be like you and call me a garbage ferret, which still is the greatest name ever. But congratulations for hitting 10K. I'm convinced that even if you didn't do content, you would still hit 10,000 because you had 1,000 subscribers before you even put up your first video. How anyone does that, I have no idea. But she deserves 110% the success that she's getting. She works hard. She's very involved in the community. I love her to death. I couldn't be more proud of her. And she is, to this day, the thing I am looking forward to the most at Faithless Forum on the 27th, which, by the way, is sold out. We have sold out Faithless Forum for Dallas, Texas. So congrats on that as well. Tomorrow we're going to be doing debate roulette again. We're going to do it like we did last time. If you guys are interested in being a part of that, there is a channel in Discord. It's called Debate Roulette Suggestions, I think. Go there, post your argument or whatever you're passionate about, whatever you'd like to debate about. Somebody will be reading through those. You know, everybody go there and look. If you see something that you would want to debate that person on, or if you disagree with a particular point, tag your name to it. I'll come through tomorrow and line everybody up. But that seemed to work a lot better than the way we used to do it. So if you have something that you want to argue, go there, post it, and then people who want to debate can go in there and sort of match up that way, and we'll bring you on. Saturday, Red's Rhetoric returns to Friday nights. So he's been gone for quite a while, and we look forward to having him back. And then finally, we're going to be continuing the anti-vax stories on Sunday. I think we're going to have somebody that is an actual anti-vaxxer coming on to have a conversation with Jeff Holiday. So make sure you join us on Sunday for that. This was great. A huge thanks go out to both of these gentlemen. They couldn't have been more cordial, and this is so far outside the realm of how the debates usually go on here. It's kind of nice. It's a breath, especially after these past couple of days. Civility is actually nice to see, but maybe tomorrow we can get back and have us a good old fashioned dumpster fire again. One more time, Worley DR podcast. He has the link in the live chat. You can click that and go and see my detailed response on the controversy that happened with, as he calls it, Ethnogate. It was a great interview, so make sure you check that out. Other than that, we'll see you back here tomorrow at 8 p.m. Eastern, where we will let you guys come on and bring your arguments. I don't have I didn't look up a catchy close phrase tonight. So, Steve, it's on you. You've been on vacation. Spit out some wisdom.
The multiverse is a real thing, and we're going to be talking about different levels in the multiverse. Come join us on this weekend with actual astrophysicist. There you go.
Astrophysicist.
I think it's astro. Astro. Ask my ass.